Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greenhorns, this is Severin, and this is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers, coming to you today from New Mexico, where we're preparing for a symposium of agrarian trust, talking about land commons in history and across cultures. Today, I'm joined by Ryan Powers, who's in just north of San Francisco in Sonoma County. Hi, Ryan.
Hey.
Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Well, it's good to be here. I'm doing fine. How about you?
I'm doing, I'm verging in on fine. When I met you, Ryan, you were on an island near Chattanooga, Tennessee. Do you want to talk a little bit about that farm, your first farm, and then tell us about the farm you're on now?
Sure. Yeah, so that was more, I consider that more of a wild adventure than a farm. But we grew food and raised animals, and some friends and I had just completed the apprenticeship at the UCSC farm in Santa Cruz, California, and decided to go out there. We received an invitation to start something on that island and went out there to Williams Island. And started about a 20-acre mixed operation. And it just fizzled after a few years, and everybody kind of went their separate ways. I moved back west where I'm from. And in 2010, started this farm, new family farm, in Sebastopol with my best friend, Adam Davidoff. And we're still going. We're in our, I guess, this will be the seventh season coming up. And it's less of a wild adventure and more of a real running farm.
Well, the wild adventure part, seems like it's a part of the portal that brings a lot of people into agriculture, and seems like it's part of the training process for contending with the logistics of every day, is exposing oneself to the patterns of chaos. But
yes, I agree.
There were a lot of interesting issues on that island that you were contending with, and I feel like those issues, you had the beautiful wild osprey, and you had the manure, human septic waste being spread on fields. You had GMO corn farmers. You had dead baby calves. You had mining, strip mining on the river. You had private prep school things. Maybe is there anything you could say that's succinct that links what you learned there in that wild adventure part to what you're what are the similar factors there to what you're experiencing in kind of suburban Bay Area?
Well, it's the way people live here and there is very similar and also pretty different. I think that here the only kind of agriculture that you're exposed to are the old apple orchards and wine grapes. Whereas there's tons of animals, and that humanure, which actually the ranchers were paid by the waste treatment plant to use because they just have to get rid of it, was being grown or being used right there next to our farm. Smelled terrible. Now they use it out here too. It's just on hay fields. A lot of things are similar, actually. We've got GMO corn being grown here. We've got GMO corn being grown there. It's ubiquitous, as you know. Most of the corn grown here in the United States is GMO. I'm not really sure if there's that much of a difference or an attitude difference for food production there than there is here. The vineyards are sucking up the groundwater to produce something that you might think of as frivolous, alcohol. And so I think the industrial agricultural mindset is entrenched almost anywhere you go.
So what do you mean when you say new family farm? What are the values that are inferred in your initiative, in your mission that you're setting for yourself as a farm?
Well, we started the farm with an intention to cultivate food, but also community and family and neighborliness. And we were also committed to using draft horses instead of tractors, and we had a few years there just only using draft horses, and I remember actually seeing you at the draft horse workshop in Mendocino, at Doc Hamill's workshop, and then from there we just kind of took off with it. That was 2011, I think, and it worked, but we've switched to tractors now, and that's a different story. But we want to grow food that's clean and healthy and full of micronutrients, and we want to do it in a way that's fun and enjoyable and beautiful. I think more importantly than anything is that it is appealing to the senses as natural beings. Things that we perceive as beautiful, I think, are also healthy and beneficial. And also, we want to have community, and we do have community that naturally forms around small, intentional farms somehow. And we want to also, besides growing food and besides having good people around, we want to continue to learn and be students of the natural world, immersed in the natural world, and fulfilled there.
And what does it take to do that? I feel like there's a little story. There's a story kernel there in your switch from the horses to the tractors, and it feels like maybe something that you're working out is how to make feasible those goals.
Yeah.
What were the factors? What were the factors that were informing your decision as you made an inflection between those different types of traction?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, it just wasn't it wasn't working. Our soil is where we learned to use the draft horses was in the mountains, where it's just covered in snow all winter. Spring comes around, and really, as soon as it's dry enough, you might have a little bit of grass or something, but you could just get in there. It's really sandy soil. You could use the plow or the disc, and it would work. Here, we had 7-foot-tall cover crop, just full of grass and legumes, and without a mower, and even if you want to use one of those deck mowers, it just kind of knocks it down when it's that big anyways. And then you go out there with a little tiny horse disc, and it just rolls over everything. And so we ended up hiring a tractor, custom tractor work, a few times anyways, because it just didn't work. And I think that it could have worked. It could work. Obviously, people farmed around here before tractors. And I think that you need a community of people working horses, because we couldn't have the amount of horses that were needed for spring field work. Then they wouldn't be necessary throughout the whole rest of the season. You only needed 2, whereas in the spring you maybe needed 5 or 6. I mean, the soil dries down, and then it's too dry to work. and the pace of field work is much slower with the draft horses, which is something I preferred and prefer. However, when you've spent a week opening one field and then your other field is too dry to get into, you're kind of in a pickle. If you're trying to grow all these crops and make a living and have that financial sustainability part. So it just didn't work, reason one. Reason two was energetically the extra time needed to be a horseman, to be a horse person, to train and to love those horses and use them as often as we could. We're kind of stuck between highways and roads with lots of cars, and the horses didn't like how short our fields were and had to turn around more often than they would have liked, and they balked at the work because of that. And we were so exhausted from growing vegetables and trying to make a living and learn how to, you know, and learning how to grow vegetables too. I mean, you start your farm, you're not an expert right away. So we were both beginning farmers and beginning horse workers, and so we just didn't have the energy to do both of those things. So it was a tough decision, and they were definitely some of the best friends I've ever had. And I think that they taught us more than people have taught us. And I was sad to see them go. However, I'm excited about the potential that we have with the tractors, the potential for more precise management, better use of cover crops. I think there's a lot of potential that we weren't able to tap into that we can now that really excites me. So moving forward, I'm stoked.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting potential that I've been talking to Upper Midwest Precision, you know, regenerative ag, restoration ag, you know, precision permaculture peeps up in Wisconsin and Iowa and stuff. And, like, these guys are so, you know, this is like Farm Hack Boys, total focus is how can we do, you know, enlightenment theory, open source agriculture, and monitor our magnificent impacts as we concoct these super localized cover crop and crop sequences and do no-till and just, you know, use the magic of technology for good.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
Oh, I was just going to say that studying environmental studies and learning about the way we as people have treated the earth and how quickly we can destroy, cut down entire forests or blow off the top of mountains or deplete topsoil so quickly. It's scary how quickly and easily we can destroy. And it's only been recently that I've realized that it's just as easy to create and to be regenerative as it is to destroy. And it only figures we can use this stuff for good, like you're saying.
Well, I don't know that it's just as easy, but I'm not going to get in an argument with you about it. One of the themes that's been coming up a lot lately in our young agrarian movement and new economy movement and in the co-op movement and just kind of overall in the economy that is intentional and values-based, that's trying to be building itself into strength, into capacity to be a real alternative for a significant portion of the food and nutrition and services than the corporate and the Walmart economy, is that this kind of understory economy or emergent economy or new economy is really, really struggles to contend with the distorted values of the mega economy or the overstory economy, and that those values are clashing in a lot of different ways, and that the clash is being felt by our protagonists and the young farmers, and that young farmers are having a hard time, and the hard time is, you know, can be characterized in a couple different ways, and a lot of those stressors are to do with the way value is assigned. And so, for instance, in that Walmart economy, wages are low. In the general ag economy, about 70% of the workforce has no citizenship, and so the wages are low. Mm-hmm. In that generalized ag economy, land values are not justifying the agricultural value of the crops because of a distorted subsidy system that wants to create, as a federal policy, cheap food. And so these distortions in the mega economy and these, you know, the way that the mega economy is structured to exploit people and places, you know, has a negative structural impact on what we're kind of all going with our jelly red cheeks trying to build. And a lot of young businesses and new businesses have been experiencing kind of the raw burn of rubbing up against that overstory economy. This isn't necessarily a question that, you know, you have to answer, you know, to expose any weaknesses of your own, but maybe just a little bit of reflection about, from a North Bay perspective, in the kind of like watershed of tech and in a place that's having a lot of gentrification of the countryside, how do you make sense of this yourself, and what are the conversations that are happening in Sonoma about how to hold our economy together and interact with the mega economy?
Do you mean myself, like, how am I making it?
Well, you can answer it if you want, but you could also just be philosophical. I know that you honestly have to be very philosophical.
Yeah, I don't think I would be making it up here if it weren't for my family being here and for white privilege. I wouldn't be here to answer that personally. And then philosophically, something that's really, not philosophically, practically speaking, something that's really exciting that's happening right now in the Bay Area, where the tech is, as you mentioned, is they're now expressing a desire to source their food. And, you know, these campuses where the tech companies are situated are huge, and they're serving something like 40,000 meals a day. They've got restaurants inside their campuses. We're seeing a shift in the way that those institutions want to purchase. And as you know, when big institutions shift their purchasing habits, there's a lot of power in that, and that's a way to institutionalize what we're doing, sort of a safety net or a foundation, another way to sell it. I think people start these organizations up here. Farmers Guild, for example, which is an amazing organization. The Grange coming back around. There's other ones. You know, how can we help? How can we serve what you guys are doing? And my answer then, and I guess still kind of now, is just help me sell more of my food easier for more money. because help educate the consumers who are being trained by that, what did you call it, just big economy? They're being
mega
trained.
Mega economy.
The mega, it's mega. And it's training them how to see food, how to eat. I mean, Wendell Berry, I just read this Wendell Berry thing last night, where he's like, if they could find a way to just put it in your mouth pre-chewed, they would, you know. And educating the people that real food is better and that it's worth a little bit more money, that's a lot of work, but that's really important. It's happening. These organizations are putting it together. I mean, even the school systems around here are saying, look, we want to buy from you. We can pay this much on you know, per box of various crops. So there's a lot of support, and it's easy. And we sell 99% of what we grow, not counting the stuff that's culled out. You know, there's very little waste in our operation. So it's easy to sell. So I think the challenge that we had in Tennessee on that island was that it wasn't easy to sell. And what we have as a product is a piece of food, you know, and then you could go to the store and also get a piece of food. You could go to Walmart and get that same piece of food for less. And what's different? I've got this beet right here. Is it better than the beet at Walmart? I don't know. How do you differentiate between that? How do you tell the story of that beet? Wine does it. You can have wine that's $10 or $2, and you can have wine that's $9,000 for a bottle. Certain agricultural products somehow can do that. But so that's where we're at right now, you know, up here, is just continuing that education, creating more markets. And once the markets are there, then learning how to grow food better, more efficiently, to fill them.
I just was out in Thermal, California, at the research station, University of California, Riverside Extension Research Station, where they have a date experiment station and a citrus experiment station. And according to the land manager there, who's just wonderful, I was going there talking about, you know, drought crops of the future and, you know, looking at all this drought situation in the West and thinking that in an agricultural system that's dominated by, well, in terms of decision-making, is dominated by white men in their 60s, the mentality of white men in their 60s doesn't necessarily include forethought of the next 60 to 100 years in terms of, you know, perennial tree crops and beyond citrus and these high irrigation crops. So anyway, I was out there having this conversation with yet another white man in his 60s, and he's just a sweetheart. You know, it was a really wonderful conversation. And he said to me that the date, you know, the date industry is the most kind of schismed, mosaic, disorganized crop group there is. And the only reason that the date research station is still going is that it's kind of hitched to the citrus. Citrus being one of the most coordinated crop groups. And so it really struck me, watching the stagnation of the citrus industry and watching the stagnation of so many crop groups and the stability that that stagnation has as a result of a lot of forethought and coordination, you know, during the prime days of that industry. And so in the case of citrus, you know, the same thing could be said for Texas cotton, you know, which makes not a lot of sense in terms of how little water there is out there, but the fact that it can persist has a lot to do with the coordination and intense organization that went on earlier in history. And I'm talking about cooperative gins, cooperative electricity, you know, obviously the activities of marketing as a group, adding value by owning their own mills as a group, owning their own cut-and-sew factories down in Latin America as a group, in the citrus industry, owning their own packing houses, their own marketing board, their own train cars, their own insect pest, you know, beneficial insect farms, and, you know, paying membership into those farms. So these coordination efforts of these crop groups that, you know, basically formed around the spouts of the big water dams of the New Deal era, in the case of California, these coordinated groups are what hold these farmers together. And the question I'm having, you know, in terms of how do we act as young farmers in our own economies and supporting what you're asking for, which is how do I sell my food better for more and keep the story together, is what are the ways that we can formalize that path to market? And, you know, technology in California is kind of like the end spout of a big dam. I mean, it's another little boom town. It's another little vein of ore in our economy, and it seems like getting it right as we interact as agrarians with the tech community is pretty crucial, because otherwise the tech community will apply some of the logic that they learned on their screens out onto the landscape. So we better figure out how to communicate effectively to them and, you know, train them into a truce with us.
Yeah.
Anyway, your thoughts? You could react to that, or you could ignore it completely and say what you want to say.
Well, if the question was how to do that, I can tell you that there's a really awesome food hub called Feed Sonoma that is managed mostly by my friend Tim Page, and he's putting this stuff together. I mean, he's doing that advocacy and putting these pieces together. He got us down into the very first Google farmers market that happened inside their building on the sixth story in San Francisco. And they got to come in and just take whatever food they wanted. For all the employees, they call them Googlers, got to just come in and just take whatever they wanted from the table. They had pre-bought everything, but anyways, it was a cool perk for the employees there. And so that was their idea. They've got a person who, I don't remember her name, but her job is to create a connection between Google and food. And they're paying her to do it. One of the perks of expendable income, I guess. But creating
that
relationship now is crucial.
But that's, of course, the iconic experience of the Essex farm is all you can eat kind of decommodified food. Like, you just take what you want.
Right, right. And I think that those companies are all offering their employees lots of perks. You can work out here. You can take a nap in our nap room. I mean, seriously, you can. There's a restaurant on the roof that specializes in cheese. I'm not making this up. My friend works at Facebook. He told me all this stuff, that perks that sound great. And this is just another perk. Like, you can have free organic food from local farms. It's the best food you can get, and they're just offering it. And so doing that education, and the way that then it filters through the programs and iPhones and apps of that world, I don't know how that's going to pan out, but I think that...
Wait, I like what you're just saying. You're saying the opposite of what I was saying, because I was saying, how are these minds that are acculturated by the iPhone screen and by what's possible to synchronize and synaptically link, how does that translate out into landscape? You're saying, how does the landscape of abundance, which is the kind of like free-form peasant life, essentially translated through utopian campus experience, going to translate back into tech? Ooh, I like the reciprocity thinking.
Yeah,
okay,
and it is. They've made like a couple apps that I think one's called Good Eggs or something, and you can just go on your phone and just like find the best bunch of beets in the North Bay. You know, they're making it easy to access what we're doing, and how to prove the worth of what we're doing. It's funny because there's this whole world of I think, educated people who understand why they've read Michael Pollan, they're familiar with what the greenhorns are, you know, and they're like, yeah, I want to buy this. I'm going to buy it. Sure, how do I get it? And then there's the people that are actually buying my food mostly, which are buyers at grocery stores, produce buyers at grocery stores. And, I mean, more than one of them will tell you, I've been working in grocery stores since I was 15 or 12, and I love it. And it's different. And having to sort of convince them, the middlemen and women, to buy what I have and to pay a little bit more for it on the by case, or sometimes I match those prices, and they're coming around. And really, it goes both ways, because the consumers are getting all this information, why should we do this, and then bringing it to the stores, this is what we want. And then the stores are saying, this is what we have, how can I get this? And we're connecting the dots. They're connecting. I can tell you. I mean, we picked a whole chain of stores, just made this whole flip to saying, all right, we're now we want to buy as much as we can from you. That's their stated goal, you know. So something's clicking.
Click, click, said the mouse, and then he got eaten by a barn cat. Okay. I like where this is going. I'd like to take it offline with you sometime over a beer. There's going to be a bunch of interesting stuff happening at Eco Farm next weekend. I'm going to be there hustling greenhorns almanacs at the Rincon Vitoba table. They're hustling predatory insects. And we ran out of time, which is normal. You got anything you want to announce that's coming up, or any jobs you have offered, or final hurrah?
Well, we are hiring for this coming season. And just a hurrah out there for the people who are living on land, farming, and loving it, and seeing the beauty of it. And holding that close in their hearts, and knowing that it's worth so much, you know. Just a shout out to all my brothers and sisters who know what I'm talking about.
Loving the life. Thank you. Big love to you, Ryan, and big love to all of you out there. Everyone's getting their seed orders.
Yep.
As you're thinking about your winter time and allocating the longer dark periods of life, indoor periods of life, consider writing an essay for the next New Farmer's Almanac. It doesn't have to be 5 pages. It could only be 1 page. It could be half a page. It could be 2 pages. Our theme is the commons of the atmosphere, of the soil, the ocean, the internet, how the ways that we engage with and the governance practices that we as stakeholders involve ourselves with. It's a pretty broad theme. You can pretty much write about whatever you're thinking about.
All
and
right.
If you email almanac@thegreenhorns.net, then you'll be on the listserv to get the prompt and a lot of sub-theme thoughts. And if you get us your thinking early enough, then we can commission the illustrations that go along with your essay. But all of it's due in February and really starts tinkling into March. But now is the time to put pen to paper, or clickety-clack. Greenhorn's New Farmer's Almanac, still available. We do it every other year now because we just can't pull it off every year. So thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.